Okay, before we get started, so let's just make a commercial announcement, and that is that the next two Sundays, I will have a substitute here. Rabbi Sam Shore from the Israel Center will give a two-part series on the Haggadah. I'm going to be in the San Francisco, Las Vegas area on Sunday, not gambling away my life. On Monday morning, I have a lecture to give at a Jewish Studies conference. And the Sunday afterwards, I will be in New York City, coming back from Miami from Shabbos after a speaking engagement and boarding a plane in the evening. So it's getting a little difficult to get here for the shiur. Okay? They're over there on the table. I have enough for everybody. Okay, Yofi. Okay, so although we did not really finish that last page on the Rambam of Perush HaMishnah, we'll get to it yet. But today, because it's right before Purim, I would like to spend some time on a very, very important detail of Purim that many times is overlooked. I mean, I think to a crowd like this, you know that the main part of Purim has nothing to do with eating hamantashen or even getting dressed up. I mean, and I'm not belittling the idea of the tachboset. I think it unifies the country. I don't know if you've seen pictures of this morning, if you have grandchildren or great-grandchildren going to school this morning, but I got a whole slew of pictures already. And Baruch Hashem, you know, in these ridiculous times, to be able to smile and get a kick out of the way the kids are dressed up. The Rav Zichron Lebracha once alluded to the idea of getting dressed up on Purim, And it's mentioned even by the poskim, by the way, in the context of whether or not a man is allowed to wear women's attire on Purim as a getup, as a costume. And there are, and as everything, as you know, in my language, it's a machloket. You know, so there are different opinions here. So there are the machmirim who say, God forbid, I mean, this is a biblical violation. You know, it's in Parshat Ki Tetzé, how can you allow it? And the other opinion says that we can let loose here and be lenient because the biblical violation is promotion of promiscuous activity, which obviously is not the intent if somebody just masquerades as a man or a woman in the opposite gender, and it's all for Simchat Purim, and we can just let it go. So, you know, I'm not here to be a posek. I'm just bringing to your attention you have these two opinions. So it is mentioned in the Sifrei HaPoskim, which means that's not a silly thing. Or even banging by Haman, also has a basis that Poskim will talk about, and it's not just a kid's thing. Of course, you have to realize it's gotten out of hand. And to the extent that many Poskim of late have said, let's tone this down because people don't hear the Megillah. They're just so busy with all kinds of contraptions of how to make noise by Haman, they're not busy listening to the Megillah or letting others pay attention to the Megillah. And then, of course, there are different customs in shul, you know, whether you bang by every Haman or just by Haman Agagi, who says Haman Agagi, or the first and the last, and whatever it is, these are innovations of shuls just to maintain the decorum, and as simple as that. But the idea of making noise had nothing to do with Gragers. Gragers came into being by all kinds of arts and crafts, Jewish artists. But the idea was to write on the soles of the shoe the name Amalek or the name Haman, and then to stamp with your feet to rub it out. You know, if you have chalk and you write Amalek or you write Haman, you stamp it out and you fulfill the mitzvah of Timcha Etzech Amalek. You are erasing Amalek. That's where it all started. And then from that became firebombs and shuls and don't ask what. You know, during the days of the Intifada, I was in Ramot and I forbade kids from bringing firecrackers to shul. First of all, it's dangerous. I told the parents, do not allow it any year. I don't care what. But, you know, in a year where people were just jumping to hear any type of explosion, that you know, could give a person a heart attack just then and there, just to hear an explosion. So I think, and people bring all kinds of contraptions. To which is really crazy. But the Rav once said, as just an allusion to the fact that people get dressed up, he said that, you know, the Torah says about the war of Amalek in Parshat B'Shalach, that we will read it in the Torah on Wednesday morning on Purim, and they're going to read it this Tuesday at the rest of the places. It says Timchet Zecha Malek Mitachat. Sorry, it says Kimachoy Emchet Zecha Malek Pashat Bishalach. Kiyad Al Kes Yam Milchama Lashem Ba Amalek Midor Dor. That the Kadosh Baruch Hu says there's going to be a war with Amalek in each generation. And I've said here many times over that when we say / sing at Seder night, Shebechol Dor Vador Omdim Aleinu Lachaloteinu in the Vishya Amda, that Bechol Dor Vador emanates from the Pasuk, Milchama Lashem Ba Amalek Midor Dor. So if the Torah says that there will be a war of Amalek every single generation, you can rest assured that it's true. It's going to happen. But the Rav said, Amalek masquerades each generation in different costume and uniform. One year he's a Muslim, one year he's a Christian, one year he's from this country, from that country. The fact that the Amalekim appear in different scenes, in different eras, is suggestive of camouflaging one's real identity, but we know the truth. So the Rav said that an Amaleki is not somebody who starts up with Jews, who throws eggs at kids coming home from yeshiva on the night of Halloween that I remember well in New York City. You know, that where all of a sudden this anti-Semitic feeling was allowed to let loose on the night of Halloween, where we were bombarded by eggs. And I remember they would scream at us, dirty Jews, and we had a response to that. But you pray to one, and then we got a whole dozen. Yeah. So, just be careful how to respond sometimes. But the idea of Amalek reappearing, so the Rav always explained the Rambam, that the Rambam drew our attention to the fact that Amalek was never really eradicated. It's still here. And it has to do with policy. And the policy is laid out in the Megillat Esther. Lashmid, larog, ulabed et kol ayudim, minar vad zaken, taf nashim, biyom echad. In one time framework, we're not talking about 24 hours, in one time framework, total annihilation of Am Yisrael. That's Amalek. So is Nazi Germany Amalek? Yes, it was Amalek. Is Germany post-war Amalek? The first few years, there were many people, including the Rav, who had this feeling of Amalek. It was too close to the scene. And I'm sure you all remember, because I remember as a child, don't buy German products, especially Volkswagen cars, because the Volkswagen company certainly cooperated with making machinery for the gas chambers. We know that. But I can tell you that in the 70s already, which is now 30, 35 years after the World War II, the Rav softened up a little bit, like many of us, and recognized that then West Germany and ultimately United Germany is no longer the same place. It's not Nazi Germany, it's a democratic country. And not only that, but forget about the Shilumim, the reparations, that this country exploded in the early 1950s between Ben-Gurion and Begin. Begin also rocked the country with demonstrations against the acceptance of the Shilumim. Ultimately, not everybody took them, but a lot of people did take them and use them for various good causes to keep them going and so on. You can never return people, that's for sure, but there was a lot of loss of property and money and so on in the process. And at least there, Germany, unlike Poland and unlike other countries, you know, did not want to make good, but Germany did make good on that level. And of all things, from a diplomatic point of view, turns out that Germany and Poland are very, very allied with Israel today. That's nothing less than miraculous that after all that we went through during the days of the Shoah. And therefore, to say that modern-day Poland, modern-day Germany, you know, is all Amalek. So we can talk about fundamentalist Islam as Amalek. I would never, ever say every Arab is Amalek. I wouldn't say that. I happen to know some Arab people who happen to be decent people. But there's certain regimes. And I would even say I wouldn't call the Iranian nation Amalek, because the Iranian nation are captive to the government. And I hope one day they overthrow them. And it might happen. There are some signs at the grassroots level of so much dissent that's going on that it could happen that the Ayatollah regimes will be overthrown. But that's Amalek, because they talk about the annihilation of Israel as a people and the Jewish nation at large. And of course, God willing, that we said it in Haftarah yesterday, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, right? There's a certain Netzach quality to Am Yisrael. But unfortunately, as Yaakov Avinu experienced in his encounter with Esav, which was the forerunner of Amalek, he walked away Tzolea al Yericho, limping. So he survives, and he survives miraculously, but he's limping. And the Medrash says, Elu Dorot Hashmad, those are the generations that we lost to succumbing to Christianity and Islam and others, theologically and by the sword. Elu Dorot Hashmad. And unfortunately, we paid a bit of price, but we're still here to talk about it. And others 2,000 years ago are no longer here to talk about it. So the Rav did allude to the idea of masquerading and dressing up when he was referring to Amalek, that Amalek dresses up and so on. And who knows, where maybe that's where the custom of dressing up may have come from, that it's a Yom Tov of masquerading of sorts. Okay, but be it as it is, there's something far more important and central to Purim than getting dressed up or eating Hamantashen. So obviously it's the reading of the Megillah. And then the accessory mitzvot that come along for the ride, and that's the Sudat Purim and Mishloach Manot and Matanot Levyonim. What's interesting is that Mishloach Manot is linked to the Suuda, and Matanot Levyonim is linked to the reading of the Megillah. And you'll ask me, what does that mean? Well, do you know that even here in Yerushalayim, we sometimes have Purim where we split the Suuda and the reading of the Megillah? And that is when Purim comes out on Shabbat. When the 15th of Adar comes out on Shabbat, so we will read the Megillah on the 14th on Friday, but we'll have the Suda on Sunday. We call it triangular Purim, Purim Mishulash, because on Shabbat we say Al HaNisim. We say Al HaNisim, and we have a special Torah reading for Maftir, and we have the Haftarah, which is just take two of Parsha Zohar. We reread the same thing we read yesterday in Yerushalayim when you have Purim on Shabbat. We just reread the story about Shaul and Shmuel and Agag from Amalek. So there's a special Haftarah, special Maftir, Al HaNisim. The Divrei Torah is supposed to be Purim-oriented, and so on. So there is something to be said about Purim on Shabbat, but the Megillah is Friday, and the Masuda is on Sunday. What about the Mishloach Manot and Matanot Levyonim? So the Matanot Levyonim is Sunday, because it's attached to the Suda, and the Mishloach Manot is on Sunday, and the Matanot Levyonim is on Friday, with the reading of the Megillah. And there, the Poskim point out, because it's Pavlov's dog. What's Pavlov's dog? You know the story of Pavlov's dog? That Pavlov's dog was Pavlov's dog was the experiment by the scientist Pavlov, who demonstrated certain reactions to stimuli. So they would give a dog a dog bone and ring a bell. And they would give a dog dog bone and ring the bell. You see, the animal is salivating just by seeing the dog bone. And after a few days, they just rang the bell and the dog salivated, because there was an association of the bell ringing with getting food. So when the reading of the Megillah comes about, those who are collecting for Matanot Levyonim, their hands are stretched out. It's Pavlov's dog. So they're all accustomed and conditioned. It's conditioning, rather. That's the official word. It's conditioned response. So there's a conditioned response by Aniyim Levyonim to come by when there's Megillah reading. So the Poskim said, let's not disappoint them and wait till Sunday when we have the Suda. Because essentially, Matanot Levyonim is that they should have food for money to buy food for the Purim Suda. But okay, this Pavlov's dog, this conditioning response here, so we give it on Friday. But so therefore, the Matanot Levyonim is now linked to the Megillah reading. And the Mishnah says it, by the way, with regard to when you have other Rishon and other Sheni, Shana Muberet, the leap year, Ein Bein Adar Rishon Adar Sheni Ela Mikra Megillah Umatanot Levyonim. Now, of course, everybody asks, what happened to the Suda? What happened to the Shlach Manot? So people say the Mishnah abbreviated, yeah, etc., as if to say, Mikra Megillah, Matanot Levyonim, etc., etc. Yes, of course. When there's Shana Muberet, we don't make a Su'udah in the first Adar. We don't have Shlach Manot in the first Adar. Everything is deferred to the second Adar. Yet, there are some poskim who will recommend having somewhat of an upgraded Sudat Purim in the first Adar of the 14th or 15th, depending on where we are. Upgrade means more than a regular launch.
Upgraded lunch.
Upgraded lunch. Well, a downgraded Sudah, but an upgraded lunch. A better quality lunch or dinner. you know, just to show that it's, yeah, it's, because maybe it does mean the Suda also. But no. The Rav explained that what the Mishnah is teaching ain't bein ella. There's no difference between Purim of Purim, we call Purim Katan, and Purim Gadol of Adar Rishon Adar Sheni, ella, except. What do you mean except? That's all it is, right? No, okay. So let's even assume it includes, etc., and includes the Mishloch Manot and the Suda. The Rav said, the ain't bein ella, what do you have in the first Adar? What do you have? Forget about Minhagim now. Purim carries with it do's and don'ts. So the do's, we know, the four big do's, the Megillah, the Suda, the Mishloch Manot, Matanot Yevonim. But they're don'ts. There's no hespedim, no eulogies, no fasting, and of course the big one, no tachnun, right? Especially if it's a Monday or Thursday. No tachnun. So the don'ts apply to Purim Katan equally like in Purim Gadol. So if there's a levaya on Yud Dalet or Tetvav of Adar Rishon, there should not be eulogies, no hespedim, and nobody should have a fast day on that day. And we don't say tachnun in shul that day in our davenings. So that means that there is some level of Simchat Purim, but it expresses itself only on the level of the do-nots, the don'ts. But the do's, we defer to Adar Sheni. That's what it means. Ein ben el Adar Rishon. There's no difference between Purim in the first month and the second month of Adar, when there are two Adarim. Except A, B, or A, B, C, and D. The do's. The do's defer to Adar Sheni. Fine. So we see that Mishloch Manot is connected to the Suda. That's clear according to everybody. What does that mean? It means that the idea of Mishloch Manot unifies the Suda of every single Jew. Because you prepared a menu, and you take two items from your menu, and you bring it over to the neighbor. And the neighbor takes two items from his or her menu, and you bring it over to a neighbor. So in theory, everybody's eating from everybody. And that was the original idea of Lech Kinos et Kol HaYudim. Let's create a scenario where everybody is having one meal. Of course, you can't have one, get all Klal Yisrael into your dining room. So we do it by this little gimmick called Mishloch Manot. That if I give to you, and the one gives to the third, to the fourth, to the fifth, to the fifth, to the sixth. So in essence, everybody is ultimately eating something from everybody by having Am Yisrael give each other Mishloach Manot. One of the problems today, and I say it with great pain, that there are no small number of people who don't eat from the neighbors. Okay. We know it's true. I mean, I say it with great pain. I say it with great pain. And what has become of Mishloach Manot, it has degenerated into Bisli and Bamba, which means packaged goodies. Packaged goodies, you know, you go to various stores, and they'll sell you now packages with the cellophane on top of it already, with a nice sign your name, and you're in business, and that's it. You just give it. It has a little bottle of wine, it has some cakes, have some this, that, that. What we do is we prepare some small kugels, and we prepare some, you know, baked products, whatever it is. Okay, small bottle of wine or grape juice is in order, beseda. And that's it, you know, not to overdo it with the junk food. Because when I was a rabbi in Be'er Sheva, I used to, people, because out of kavod, they gave me Mishloach Manot. I had so much junk food. And it's, you know, it's before Pesach. People have to remember, before Pesach, what do you do with it? So I told my kids, go to Soroka Hospital, we live three blocks away, go to the children's ward, and just give it out. Give it out. That's it. Finish. My kids went, and they got in touch with me. You know, there are a lot of Bedouin kids there. I said, you give it to the Bedouin kids also. And that's a halacha too. Mechalkin matanot l'avyanim l'aniye goyim mishum darkei shalom. Can you imagine if you go into a ward and there are six kids there and you leave two kids out? How can you do that? As they asked the Shiloh. They asked me the Shiloh. They wanted to know, seriously, what should they do? First of all, the mitzvah of getting junk was mitzvah to listen to my wife. Just get rid of this stuff, right? So it was win-win-win, this whole thing. But it was a great experience for the kids to go to the take the stuff to the children's ward and give it out. That's all. And when we lived in Ramot, so I remember we used to go to the army checkpost entering Ramot. Just give it to the chayalim. It's not gonna remain before Pesach. That's for sure. They're gonna finish it off. That's all. But the idea of giving food that was prepared in your kitchen, I'll just digress. You know, every rabbi has his greatest day in the rabbinate and his most horrific day in the rabbinate. If you talk to Rabbanim, maybe they didn't think about it. I can tell you clearly, my most horrific day was the pigua of the Sparrow restaurant, because I had two girls from my shul who perished, and it was just a very difficult experience for me, and I had to just rise to the occasion and deal with it. It was very difficult. But it's better talking about the best experience. It happened to me in a wedding on a snow day, where a kid in the shul was getting married in Ramat Rachel, and it was a blizzard in Yerushalayim, and nobody was going to Ramat Rachel, nobody. And we decided to advise the family not to postpone the wedding. We'll make the wedding in the shul, and we're going to invite everybody in the neighborhood, and everybody's going to come to shul at 2 o'clock and give out tafkidim, jobs. And in 6 hours, everything was gorgeous. The whole shul was set up, everything, the works. Everybody, women brought their platas, the Shabbos plata to the Ezrat Nashim. They brought food and everything. There was just enough for everybody. And we had 400 people at the wedding, 50 of the originally invited guests. But 350 were just thrown in. We were just thrown in to make sameach. And it was an unbelievable. My house became the Cheder Yichud, and also before that it was the dressing room, the and the cosmetic makeup room. And I remember at the chuppah, after the chuppah, it was snowing heavy. My son Eitan, with umbrellas, were holding over the chosen kallah, and he was with a shovel making a way to get to my house. It was really a great wedding. That was absolutely great moment. And Baruch Hashem, you know, we had such moments. No, this was the wedding. We did it. And people in the shul said, if you can prepare the wedding in 6 hours, who needs 6 months to prepare a wedding? I mean, mamish. And everybody was involved in it. Why do I bring this to your attention? Because I spoke about this story once on a trip to Melbourne, Australia, and somebody gets up and he says, in your community, everybody ate from everybody? I said, yeah. Wow, that's really something. Like, that's a chidush. That's really something. Yeah. It happens to be a dinner shulchan aruch, that if somebody's trustworthy for kashrus, if he's ne'eman for kashrut, then unless otherwise indicated, you eat by them. And just recently, I heard a slew of stories of some of the Gedolei Yisrael who commenting about getting some fruits and vegetables from some kibbutz with hetar mechira, and that particular gadol was up in the north on some vacation, and said, they have a heter, so we're eating. And it was as simple as that. And, you know, the kind of business of, you know, this is treif for me, I don't eat this stuff. Let's be careful. Lech kenoset kol ha'yudim ha'nitzayim b'shushan. And the Rav said, v'tzumu alai, v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim laila v'yom. There seems to be duplication, kefal halashon. If it says tzumu alai, that means fast. Why does it have to spell it out, as they say, Barachel bitcha haktana, ba'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim? We got the point. You're supposed to fast. So what does it mean, don't eat? The Rav said in Tanakh, there are two words that speak about fasting. One is inui, affliction. Ve'initem et nafshotechem with regard to Yom Kippah. Right? And from there we learned that you don't eat, no drink. Another word in Tanakh is tzom. Tzom ravi, tzom chimi is found in Tanakh. Tzom. So what do you need two words for? She says, the inui, the word initem, tells you you're supposed to refrain from so that you do not engage in pleasurable activity, and the most important is eating and drinking. Fine. So what's tzom? You know what the word braided hair is? A tzama. When a woman takes her hair and braids it into a tzama. Tzadik mem aleph. So what do? You take loose hairs and you tie it up into one braid. Tzumu alai means Am Yisrael, who's loose, right? Who said that? So Haman said, Yeshno amechad, but mefuzar umforad ben agoyim, ben amim. There's Am Yisrael, but they're all dispersed. So Esther said, Lech kinoset kol ayudim v'tzumu alai. Let's braid Am Yisrael into one. And furthermore, al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim. 3 days and 3 nights, do not eat or drink. So the do not eat and do not drink was the, we call the fasting. But the tzom was the knisa, was the gelling, congealing of Am Yisrael into one whole. And that was the solution. Because the problem was mefuzam farad. But we're going to see now what was really the problem. So let's take a look at source number one. Source number one is the Mishnah in Masechet Megillah, the opening Mishnah, that teaches us that Megillah is read, can be read on the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th. Now, for our purposes, it's only the 14th and 15th. Right, the 11th, 12th, 13th had to do with the days of old when there were rural people who would only come to town twice a week, Monday and Thursday. So there was an allowance, the Monday, Thursday before Purim, to latch on, to piggyback on Kriyat HaTorah. So there was a laning on Monday and Thursday. So just as we have a maftir and a haftira on Shabbat or Yom Tov, so they would have like a haftira, but it wouldn't be from Nevi'im, it would be from Megillat Esther. And they would allow the reading of the Megillah for those people. It wasn't Purim for them. Purim they'd make in their rural town on the 14th and observe Purim the way they'd observe Purim without the Megillah reading, because they would have had read it already either on the 11th or 12th or 13th, depending on the Monday or Thursday before Purim, whatever would work out. And the Mishnah says, lo pachot v'lo yoter, not earlier, not later. That's it, the 11th to the 15th. Beseder. Parenthetically, there's a view in the Talmud Yerushalmi that says you can actually read the Megillah from Rosh Chodesh Adar. Not from the 11th, from Rosh Chodesh, from the 1st. As it says in the Megillah, V'ha-chodesh asher lahem ne'epach lahem yagon nesimcha me'evel yom tov. The month. So when it says months in anonymously, it always means the first of the month, unless otherwise indicated. So the Yerushalmi says that you can actually read the Megillah from Rosh Chodesh Adar. Now, okay, that's a very theoretical. Even the 11th, 12th, and 13th today is very theoretical. We don't do this. Not so theoretical. In the late 1960s, Rav Goren Zatzal was still the chief chaplain of the Israeli army, and we got our hands on our first submarines. A submarine left out of the naval base near Haifa on the 3rd of Adar, and would not be returning to port 2 weeks later, which means Purim, they're 80,000 leagues under the sea. And they didn't know what to do. Now, none of them were religious, by the way, but they wanted to hear Megillah. And so Rav Goren said, I'll give you a Megillah. No, nobody knows how to read the Megillah. So Rav Goren whips out this Yerushalmi on the 3rd of Adar, before the boat leaves, and reads the Megillah for him. Because there is a view. A Chanukah, he wouldn't do it. But after Rosh Chodesh Adar, he took the authority to do it, because the Yerushalmi says, this is extenuating circumstances. They're not going to have a Megillah. Now today, if somebody tells me they're going to be in a situation here in Israel and they don't have Megillah reading, I'm going to advise them to tune into Channel 14's live Megillah reading from the Yeshurun Shul on the Tuesday night. And you'll hear the Megillah, because the Balkaire is going to have Kavanah to be mighty anybody who can't hear it. Now you're going to say, really? You can hear the Megillah over TV and radio and a live transmission? That's been kicked around by Paiskim already for the last 50 years. And although the recommendation is, lechatchila, don't do it, but bidi avad, yeah, you can fulfill your obligation. And this is now employed in places like Shari Tzedek Hospital and other hospitals where they pipe in the Megillah to the rooms, because not every patient can make it to the 8th floor shul, or now in the new Hadassah, the downstairs Safra shul, not everybody can make it. So you're bedridden. You want to hear a Megillah, and you're not going to have somebody come to the ward to read a Megillah for you. So you can now, they now pipe it in. And because there are Piske Halacha that say, like Rav Moshe Feinstein said, L'chatchila, he doesn't like it, but it could be okay. And here in the Yerushalayim, Rav Waldenberg Zatzal from the Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Vad Yosef, they said, you know, for extenuating circumstances, yes. So that's why Kol Yisrael will broadcast the Megillah from Tel Aviv or some shul on the Monday night and Tuesday morning for those who just can't make it. Chayalim, who are out in the boondocks, you know, defending the country, and they have to stand on guard, but they can have an earphone and listen to the Megillah. It's tremendous, no? I think it's really tremendous. The fact that it can be done. But in the days of Chazal, they didn't have that. So they allowed those people from the rural areas to come to the town on Monday or Thursday and listen to the Megillah and so on. But then the Mishnah goes on to tell us what's the difference between the 14th and 15th. And what's interesting, it starts with the 15th. Now, statistically speaking, 99.99999% of the world listen to the Megillah on the 14th. And 0.01% listen on the 15th. And yet the Mishnah talks about the 15th and then gets back to the 14th. Rather odd, I would say. As I said, the Rambam was asked a question when he was sitting in Egypt from the Jewish community in Tzor. Tzor is South Lebanon, not far from Rosh HaNikra, it's south of Beirut, north of Rosh HaNikra, right in the middle. Tzor and Sidon, but this came from Tzor. And it's an ancient city, and it's mentioned in Tanakh. In all likelihood, it had a wall, from maybe even from Nezi Yeshua. And the question was, there was no remnant of the wall. And they asked the Rambam, they said, we're reading the Megillah on both days here with a bracha. Are we doing the right thing? And the Rambam said, look, you can't read the Megillah both days with a bracha. You're going to have to establish which is your main day, and that day you read with a bracha, and you can read on the other day without a bracha, just to be on the safe side. But you can't read both days with the bracha. But he says, you know what? Why don't you ask Ziknei Tzor, ask the elders in Tzor, what they remember from their grandfathers. Maybe somebody's going to have a recollection whether they read on the 14th or 15th, and on that you'll be able to determine. Fine, so that was his, otherwise read it on the 14th with a bracha, and you can reread it on the 15th. So that was his, without a bracha. So that was his psak for Tzor. So the Mishnah says, the 15th, Krachina Mukafin Choma, Mimot Yeshua Benun, those walled cities from days of Yeshua, raid on the 15th. And Kfarim Va'ayarot Gedolot Karim Be'arbasa, the others read on the 14th. Okay, so we know this. So the Gemara in source number 2 asks a question, not a question, brings an alternate view. It's walled cities from the days of Achashverosh, not from Yeshua, from Achashverosh. I mean, the story happened, Be'ahibi Me'achashverosh. So let's go back to Persia and find out which walled cities from the days of the Purim story, and so on. So you have an alternate view in the Gemara, but the Halakha is like the view of the Mishnah, which is not terribly surprising. But the Yerushalmi, in source number 3, gives an explanation to the view of the Mishnah and says, what does this have to do with Yeshua? Yeshua is not part of the story of Purim. He says, "Kerachin." Source 3, "Kerachin hamukafin chomam yemot Yeshua benun korim b'chamisha asar." That's the quote from the Mishnah. Rabbi Simon. You know what Simon is? It's Shimon. Except that apparently the guy was a Litvak, right? Rabbi Simon, kind of like Rabbi Simon Skop, right? So Rabbi Shimon, in the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, he said, "Chalko kavod l'Eretz Yisrael." We wanted to give honor and respect to Eretz Yisrael, Shaita Chareva Botam Yamim, which was destroyed in the days of the Megillah. And you know what that means? That means if we would have assigned Achashverosh to this Mukefet Choma from the days of Achashverosh, then there would be no city in Eretz Yisrael ever reading Megillah on the 15th. You'd have certain cities in Persia, certain cities in other places in the world, but not in Eretz Yisrael, which lay in ruin at the time. It was after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and it was before the building of the second Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, throughout the generations, it would be an embarrassment to Eretz Yisrael. So let's turn the clock back to Yeshua. And now, because we're doing that, we're now putting a few items on the map. You know, it reminds me when I open up Google Map, and sometimes I need certain more information, and I'll type in search, and all of a sudden, on the map that I have on the screen, more dots appear. You know, because that's what Chazal were doing. Let's type in Yeshua ben Nun instead of Achashverosh, and now more dots are going to appear on the map of Eretz Yisrael. So there are going to be some, like Yerushalayim. Tveria, by the way, is mentioned explicitly as Ir Mukefet Chomam Yemot Yeshua ben Nun, and then there are other cities that, and there are people in Tveria who reread the Megillah on the 15th. The reason they don't do it like Yerushalayim only on the 15th is because it's not sure exactly where the wall ran. But there's a fragment, there's a remnant of the wall in the hotel areas. You can see it. It's a remnant of the ancient wall of Tveria. So it was a Mukefet Choma, and it's mentioned in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi and the Gemarot as a Ir Mukefet Choma. So you have certain dots in Eretz Yisrael, and obviously Yerushalayim is the most important one. But it's not an Eretz Yisrael thing, because there was an opinion that in Prague they would reread the Megillah on the 15th, because there was a suggestion that it was an ancient city from the days of Yeshua may have had a wall. Ad kedekach. Now, okay, not everybody in Prague did it, but I'm just pointing out that this idea of Ir Mukefet Choma from the days of Yeshua Menun is not limited to Eretz Yisrael. But they did it, Chazal did it, in the names of from the days of Yeshua, so that there would be some representative cities in Eretz Yisrael that we would be reading Megillah on the 15th. Yofi. And now we jump to the Rambam, and is the Rambam always the one who makes us trouble, right? Makes for a good shiur. The Rambam says as follows. He tells us there are many different times when you can read the Megillah, and it begins with Kol Medina Shaita Mukefet Choma Mimei Yeshua Ben Nun. Underlined in source number 4. All the areas, the cities, the towns that have a walled city for days of Yeshua, whether Bein Ba'aretz Bein B'chutz La'aretz, whether it was in Eretz Yisrael or Chutz La'aretz, Afal Pi She'ein Achshav Chon. There's no wall there now. That doesn't mean anything. It had a wall in the days of Yeshua. Korim B'chamisha Sabadar. We read on the 4th, on the 15th. And the other places read on the 14th. Now I jump to Halakha Hey, the next paragraph. Shushan Abira. This town of Shushan. Afal Pi She'loi Tam Mukefet Choma Mei Yeshua. It didn't conform to this definition. They did, Shushan did not have a wall from the days of Yeshua. Nevertheless, it's read on the 15th. I confirmed this with some Persian Jews just last week, that they read the Megillah in the town called Susan, S-U-S-A-N, where the burial sites of Esther and Mordechai are still there till this very day. They would read the Megillah on the 15th. And the reason is because the nace, the miracle happened there, as the Megillah says, Shenemar v'noch b'chamishah sabo. And now the Rambam asked the very question that in the Yerushalmi, and obviously he's plagiarizing the Yerushalmi, and he says, "V'lama taluah davar b'mei Yeshua? Why did we go back to Yeshua? Kedei lachlok kavod l'Eretz Yisrael." I mean, that's almost a quote from the Yerushalmi. "Shaita chareva b'oto azman, kedei shiu korim kibnei Shushan." All these cities would be reading like Shushan. "V'yachshavu ki'ilu hen krachim hamukafim choma." Even though those cities in Eretz Yisrael might be destroyed now, but at least in those days it existed as Mukefet Choma. But now the Rambam adds, underlined, a very important addition that is not found in the Yerushalmi. V'yez zichron le'Eretz Yisrael b'nes hazeh. And by bringing the date back to Yeshua, we have incorporated some type of inclusion of Eretz Yisrael in the Purim story. What is he talking about? What kind of Eretz Yisrael inclusion to the Purim story? That's what he says. V'yeh zichron le'Eretz Yisrael b'nes hazeh. We will then be able to incorporate something of Eretz Yisrael into the memory of the Purim story. What does Eretz Yisrael have to do with the Purim story? And let's look at source number 5. Source number 5 teaches us why we don't say Hallel on Purim. So there are 3 reasons given. The first reason is what I learned in 1st grade, in 6th grade, in 8th grade, in 12th grade, and we never made a lot of progress beyond the first reason. The first reason says, because there's a difference between a miracle that happens in Eretz Yisrael and a miracle that happens in Chutz La'aretz. Hanukkah happened here, we say Hallel. Purim happened abroad, we don't say Hallel. That's the first, right? The fi she'ein omrim shira unless she'bechutz la'aretz. It was a miracle. We'll do other things, but not Hallel. That's answer number 1. Answer number 2, drop down to the next underline, Rav Nachman Amar, Kriyata Zui Halela, the very reading of the Megillah is Hallel, which means, according to Rav Nachman, against the first reason, we ought to say Hallel even on a miracle in Chutz La'aretz, except that Chazal opted for an alternative text. So normally, what is Hallel? So you open up a siddur, but where does the siddur get it from? It's cut and paste from Tillim, right? It's Tillim, Kuf Yud Gimel, Kuf Yud Dalet, Kuf Tet Vav, Kuf Tet Zayin, Kuf Yud Zayin, Kuf Yud Chet. That's Hallel. But on Purim, instead of that, we read the Megillah. It's also Hallel. And we say, Bracha, Shasan Nisim Lavoteinu, Bayim Mehem Basman Hazeh. So we fulfill our obligation of Hallel by reading the Megillah. But you do have to have Hallel in a Nesva Chutz La'aretz. This view generates an entire discussion of what happens if a person is on Purim, doesn't have a Megillah. For whatever reason, we don't have to break our heads why a person is there without a Megillah, right? The sailors under sea, they're there, let's say, without a Megillah. Should they read Hallel? If there's no Hallel on Purim, so there's no Hallel on Purim. You don't have a Megillah? Too bad, we'll see you next year. But if there is an obligation of Hallel, except the Megillah replaces the reading of Hallel, but now I'm in a scenario without a Megillah, maybe the obligation to say Hallel does return. And this led to one of the great poskim of the Eidah HaRedit here in Yerushalayim, Rav Weiss, Zichron Levracha, in his Shelot Tshuvot Minchat Yitzchak, in source number 7, to suggest that if you don't have a Megillah, you should say Hallel without a Bracha on Purim. And he raises the issue of Purim Meshulash, the triangular Purim, where we read the Megillah in Yerushalayim on the 14th on Friday. But he says, there are some poskim who say that on Shabbat, the 15th, it's like being in a scenario of Purim that you don't have a Megillah. Of course, why don't we have a Megillah on 15th on Shabbat? Because Chazal say don't read the Megillah, just like they said don't blow shofar on Shabbat and don't take the lulav on Shabbat. Don't read the Megillah on Shabbat because somebody's going to carry before they invented Erevin, you know. So they're worried that somebody's going to carry the Megillah to some teshula, to somebody's house to read the Megillah. So they said no, they wanted to prevent Chilul Shabbat. So some poskim say that the scenario of the 15th of Adar on Shabbat in Yerushalayim is tantamount to a person on Purim without a Megillah. So maybe you should read Hallel that Shabbos. I mean, we say Al Anisim in davening and in Birkat HaMazon that Shabbat. But maybe we should say Hallel. So Rabbi says, you know what? Maybe we should say Hallel without a Brocha. I mean, nobody does it, by the way. But it's entertaining the thought of Hallel without Brocha. Why? Because maybe what Rav Nachman said, Kriyata Zui Halayla, that it's really an obligation of Hallel, except that we read the Megillah instead of Hallel. But if you don't have the instead of, go back to the original and say Hallel. And why is this important? Because go back to source number 6. Let's go back to 5 and read the third view. The third view agrees with the first view that there's no Hallel on Purim, period. But why? Not because it's a Nes of Chutz Laretz, but because how can you say a Hallel, a full-throated Hallel, which is Halleluya Halu Avdei Hashem, as we say for Pesach, for Yitziat Mitzrayim, that we were left the slavery of Paro, and now we entered into the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Halleluya Halu Avdei Hashem. But at the end of the Purim story, we stayed, and we weren't fully freed from the subservience to Achashverosh. And the pasuk that says it all is the last chapter. You know, you get to Perek Yud, has 3 psukim in the Megillah, and you sigh with relief. You know, it's grinding to an end. And there's a short pasuk, Vayasem Achashverosh mas al haaretz v'iyayam. And Achashverosh levy taxes on everybody. What do you have to know that for? So you know, there's some jokers in shul who bang also by mas, because mas hachnasa, income tax, is gematria amalek. So they bang by mas, yeah, right. I don't like it, because I think it's a big, big schut to pay income. I actually believe it. I'm such a nutty tzioni that I like to pay income tax to this country, because it's fair, it's just well. That's all. So what does the pasuk come to teach you? That after all said and done, and it was a near miss. What do you mean a near miss? It was a near Holocaust. I'm not misusing the word here. Lashmid, lahogu, labedet, kol ha'yudim, minar, vatzakein, tafan, hashim, be'el, yom echad, is a near Holocaust. It was a near miss. It was business as usual. Vayasem Achashverosh mas ala aretz v'yayam. So the Gemara says, akati avdei Achashverosh anan. We remain subservient to Achashverosh. How can you really say, halu avdei Hashem? It would be a lie. So that's the third reason why we don't say Hallel on Purim. But what does the Rambam pick in source number 6? Velo tiknu Hallel b'Purim. They did not establish saying Hallel on Purim. She kriyat ha-Megillah. He Hallel. He just translates, he just brings it over from Aramaic to Hebrew. Rav Nachman's view, the second view, that says, yes, there is an obligation of Hallel on Purim. Why? Apparently the Rambam thinks that on a Nes of Chutz Laretz, you will say Hallel. Or Purim is a Nes of Eretz Yisrael. Ooh. And if Purim is a Nes of Eretz Yisrael, no different than Chanukah, then you have to say Hallel. But Chazal said, you know what? Instead of this Hallel, we'll say that Hallel, and we're Yoitzah, we fulfill our obligation. What does it mean, Purim is a Nes of Eretz Yisrael? So now we get to the meat. Let's turn the page first. In source number 10, on the third year, Bishnat Shalosh Lemocho Asa Mishteh Lechol Sarav Avadav. On the third year of Achashverosh's kingdom, his reign, he throws a big party. And at that party, he takes out not styrofoam and plastic cups, but what he has from his wife's Yerusha. Vashti, see, Achashverosh was not from royal stock. Vashti was a granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And there was a political marriage there. And Vashti knew that she was being used. And that's why when she's asked to come forth, she refuses to. But he has the Yerusha of the Klei HaMikdash, the booty from the destruction of Yerushalayim. And he takes out Klei HaMikdash. And this is what the Chazal say v'kelim v'kelim shonim, the various kelim. How does the Bakaira in Ashkenaz ritual read it? In Eicha tone. V'kelim v'kelim shonim. Just hearing about it, you have a pang of Tisha B'Av. Right there, right there. And who's invited to the party? Everyone, including Jews. How many Jews showed up? You'd think if you get invited to Ahasuerus' palace, let's get a time zone here, well, a date here. Ahasuerus follows Daryovesh, Darius the First, who follows Cyrus, Koresh, who is the one who takes over, conquers Babylon. Babel was running the show from the days of Nebuchadnezzar until 53 years after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. 53 years. Now, everybody knows that there's a 70-year prophecy, but that's Am Yisrael is coming back to Eretz Yisrael. Yirmiyahu spoke about it, Daniel spoke about it, and these things were known. 70 years. The only problem is, to know when the 70 years are up, you have to know when to start counting. And there were different markers as to when to start counting. When Koresh takes over, he issues Balfour's declaration. Why do I say that? Because Lord Balfour in 1917 opened up Sefer Chagai and wrote the Balfour Declaration based on Cyrus's edict, which gives the Jewish people the right to return to Eretz Yisrael and by license, by permit. Go back to, you don't have to fire a shot. We're allowing you to go back and build it. And just as Balfour Declaration 1 went unheeded in 1917, and of course if it would have been heeded, Jewish history would have been very different, Cyrus's edict went unheeded. And Ahasuerus has a tradition that the 70 years is up in the third year of his kingdom. When did it begin? It began 11 years before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash in the days of Galut Yechoniah. Yechoniah was king of Judah, and the Babylonians sent Yechoniah and the intelligentsia to Babel at the time, including Mordechai. And we say this in the Megillah, in the next quote from Esther Perek Bet. Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan abira ushmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shemi ben Kish Yishimini asher agla mirushalayim im agola asher agletayim Yechoniah melech Yehuda asher hegla Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel. Right, that's how we sing it. That's how we say it. So why is this important? Why is it put in the Megillah? To teach us that it's a marker, it's a historic marker. This is where the 70 years according to Ahasuerus began, and it ends Bishnat Shalosh L'Molcho, third year. And he throws a party. Jews are not going back to Eretz Yisrael. Yay, let's celebrate. And he invites Jews. What should Jews have done at that moment? Rip Kriya and made another Tisha B'Av. That's what they should have done. What did they do? You know how many came? According to Chazal, 18,500. 18,000. To drink a l'chaim on clay amikdash, not styrofoam cups. L'chaim, Tachashverish. We're here to stay. And they were pretty happy about it. Pretty happy about it. And then comes Haman into the picture. And then comes the Gzeira, Lashmid la'rogu la'beit. And then comes Perek Dalet, Esther Perek Dalet. Mordechai yada et kol asher na'asa. Mordechai knew everything that was going on. What does that mean? He read the papers? He listened to CNN? Everybody knew, right? They sent out to 127 Medinot. They sent it out. This wasn't a top secret at all. Haman's edict, it was public knowledge. Okay, so Mordechai knew. Everybody else knew. What is the Megillah telling us Mordechai knew? You know, in Israel, sometimes we use the idiomatic expression, asimon nafal. But you have to know what the asimonim were in the public telephones. Remember, they used to drop every 20 seconds. Or in English, we say, it clicked. It clicked, because he also was baffled. What did Am Yisrael do to deserve a gzeira? Forget about let's try to bail ourselves out. Why did it happen? Lashmid la rogu la beru kol ayudim. And all of a sudden it clicked. He realized what happened. You know what happened? Let's go back to the source on top, number 9. Dor HaMidbar, the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is a generation of Bnei Yisrael who left Mitzrayim. They saw the 10 Makot, they saw Kriyat Yamsuf, they saw Mamad Har Sinai, they saw Man and 10 other miracles that occurred to them on a regular basis for 40 years. What's the bottom line on this generation? Ein lahem chelik l'olam haba, they lose their share in olam haba. Ve'ein omdim bedin, they do not come around in triyat amitim. They lost it all. As it says, yitamu v'sham yamutu. Written off completely. Why? Why? Because they dodged the opportunity to go into Eretz Yisrael. Now here the Meraglim come back, and when you learn the Chumash, it seems that the Meraglim said, look, you know, here's wonderful fruit. Yeah, it's true. It's Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. That's all true. Efes ki Azam. We'll never beat them. They're really strong. They're giants. One second. The Egyptians had a powerful army. Sus v'rochvo. Amalek, we beat them at their game as well, even though we were attacked from the rear. Well, it's going to be a problem for Kadosh Baruch Hu to deal a death blow to the Canaanim. What happened? They forgot? 10 of the Meraglim out of 12 convinced them, we're not going to make it, we're going to perish, and that's it. So the Sfat Emet, the Rebbe of Gur, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe in a Sicha, both of them echo the exact same idea. That's not what the Meraglim said. Their convincing argument to get Am Yisrael to balk at going into Eretz Yisrael was Frumkeit. Frumkeit. This is not my idea. This is the Sfat Emet and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. What did they say? The people were told, no, we're here in the desert for a year after Matan Torah. What are we doing now, day in and day out? We don't have to go to work. Work means opening the door, taking a shovel, and scooping up the man for breakfast. That's work. And on Shabbat, don't even do that. And there's Amud Anan, Amud Ha'esh protecting us. We don't have to defend ourselves. And we don't have to buy clothing. Can you imagine? You don't have to go shopping because the clothing didn't deteriorate. Bad. Real bad. And there was no cable TV, there was no theaters, there was no ice skating and no bowling. It wasn't even a Yankee stadium. Nothing. There was nothing for entertainment. They didn't need entertainment. What were they doing all day? They were studying Torah. Man, women, child. It was an oversized kollel, and they were learning Torah 24/7. That's what they were doing. And when they heard that they have to go into Eretz Yisrael, when the Meraglim says, Ephes, take a look at these perot. Oh, this wonderful perot. Guess what? We're going to have to leave the Beit Midrash and become farmers. And guess what? We're going to have to become business people. And guess what? We're going to have to become soldiers. And guess what? We're going to have to become statesmen. And guess what? This whole enterprise of going into Eretz Yisrael is bittul Torah. We don't want it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you don't want it? You know what the phrase, Soger Lecha Tabasta? We're going to close the market, close the stand on you. That's it. You don't want? Push the delete button. You're out. Yitamu v'sham yamutu. I didn't give the Torah so we should have an oversized koilel functioning in the desert. The Torah was given to go into Eretz Yisrael, cultivate it, run it as a state, as a country, with everything that it entails. Look at Shamshon Ufal Hirsch in Parshat Toldot, reflecting on Yaakov Avinu's brachot in Parshat Vayechi. Every shevet was given an assignment of different area of national life. And that's how you build a country. Of course you need people who are going to sitting and study Torah. But you also need all the other activities to go on. And if you're not ready for that, you're not ready for Eretz Yisrael. And that's why Yitamu v'sham yamutu. And Mordechai realizes it's happening all over again. We don't want Eretz Yisrael. And you don't want Eretz Yisrael? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, fine! Lashmid, lahog, ulabed, et kol ha-yudim, minar, vad, zaken, tafen, ha-shim, v'yom echad. Shocking. Ultimately. And more, Esther says in Perichet, ki eichacha uchal v'ra'iti bara'a she'im tzat ami, ve'eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'ovdan moladati. She's talking about Eretz Yisrael. We're going to lose it all now. We're all going to go down. So ultimately, they prevail. Both on the battlefield, in the street brawls, they prevail. And something good does come out of this story. There's an 11th chapter that's unwritten. We finish with the 10th chapter. Do you ever think for a moment, okay, and now we finish the last, Ki Mordechai Yehudi Mishne LeMelech Achashverosh, Shoshah Nesiyah, Kavutah Mesamecha. What happens to Esther? She's stuck in Achashverosh's palace, left behind, and has a child with Achashverosh, who's Dariovish II, halachically Jewish, Miyu Yehudi, Jewish mother. And he encourages Am Yisrael to get the act together. And then you have already Ezra and Nehemiah coming on the scene, begging people to come to Eretz Yisrael. Slowly but surely, Shivat Zion emerges from the Purim story. It's only 5% of the population, and 95% stay in Galut. But it's good enough to get the Beit HaMikdash up and running, to get a Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael, and it happens. It happens. And the Rav said, the Purim story is the story of entering into Eretz Yisrael once again. That's the story. Look at source number 11. Source number 11, the last three lines. The last three lines. It quotes from Shirat Hayam. Ad yavo amcha Hashem, ad yavo amzu kanita. We say it every day in Oz Yashir. And these two phrases seem very similar. And the Gemara says, yeah, they are similar. Ad yavo amcha Hashem is a reference to Biyah Rishona, the days that Yeshua came into Eretz Yisrael. The first time he came in, Ad yavo amzu kanita refers to the second time he came in, zu biyah shniya. Mikan amru chachamim said, Re'uyim hayu Yisrael. Am Yisrael was worthy, le'asot lehem nes, that a miracle would have been done for them, bimei Ezra, the days of Ezra and Bayit Sheni, kederech shenasa lehem bimei Yeshua benun, just as it was done in the days of Yeshua. But, ela shegaram hachet, there was a sin. So look at Rashi, source number 12. And he says, second to the last line, Ela shegaram hachet, which chet? Ela shegaram hachet, velo alchu ela bershut korash, they were to go up with the permission of korash. Vecho yemei malchei paras nishtabu lahem, the korash ulachashverosh, v'ledarveish acharon. They could have gone up, but they didn't go up. The one who really spells it out is the Kuzari. You don't have it on this, but I'm just going to read you a section. The Kuzev, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, when he's accused by the Chaver, by the Melech Kazar, you know, Eretz Yisrael is so important, how come people didn't go and buy a Cheney? He says, Hovashtani Melech Kuzar, I am thoroughly embarrassed. You got me. You got me on this. I don't have an answer. He says, and this sin is that which prevented that which Zechariah said, Roni v'simchi bat Zion, Eretz Yisrael was prepared for this spiritual elevation in the beginning of Bayit Sheni. It didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because people were not willing to go b'nefesh chafitzah, willingly, and but only partially went back. Shavu michtzatam, v'nishar rubam u'dolehem, most of them, and the leadership. Look at this accusation there. And the leadership. They stayed in Babel. Rotzim begalut. They prefer exile. Uba'avoda shelo yipardu mimishkenotehem. They don't want to leave their beautiful homes. The inyenehem and their businesses. Or to use our words, they're all settled and set up. Their grandparents were refugees. We're not going to do this. We're all set up. We're staying here. We're staying put. And he goes on to say that this was laziness on their part. It was way beyond laziness. And he says, and these people, they say, with a lot of kavona, of course, Hishtachavu lahar kodsho, Hishtachavu lahadom raglav, techezena einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion brachamim. It's nothing but a tziftzuf hazarzir, the chirping of the bird. Or in Hebrew, we would say basfatayim, lip service. This is what happened. And that's why the Chazal say there was a Churban the second time around. So people say, oh, because there was Sinat Chinam. Yeah, that was the straw that broke the camel's back at the end. Rabbi Yehuda Levi says, Bayit Sheni didn't have a chance from day one. It did not have a chance. Because if 95% of Am Yisrael balked and didn't go, all right, so it's epis, as we say in Yiddish. Epis, it was something. Not to be sneezed at, but it didn't have a chance to survive. Long time. Certainly not to become the Yemot HaMashiach, for sure not. But nevertheless, something did come out of it. And we should celebrate this on Purim, that there was Shivat Zion. And therefore the Rav said, Chazal's drew a parallel, an analogy to Yeshua. Yeshua was the first one to bring the people in. So Purim is also an expression of bringing the people in. So we will read the Megillah in the cities that are walled from the days of Yeshua ben Nun. And that's what the Rambam meant. V'yez zichron la'eretz Yisrael b'nes hazeh. It will be a inclusion of the Eretz Yisrael idea. And that's why the Rambam says there is an obligation of Hallel on Purim, because it's also a miracle that pertains to Eretz Yisrael. And that's the Rav's idea. I'm not taking an iota credit here, okay? This was a developed shiur. Of course, it took the Rav about 2.5 hours to get it out, because we're all this flowery language. But basically, this is the gist, and it's a beautiful idea. Yeah. I speak about this. Just last night, I gave the gist of this year over to a beautiful community in Beit Shemesh, nice American community called the Beit Shamir. Right. And I told them that I used this in my brother's shul in Teaneck. For some reason, I never got invited back. I don't know why. You have to say these things. You have to say. There are certain things being politically correct. But there's a limit of how politically correct you're going to be. You have to say it. And I know that Teaneck has a very good percentage of Aliyah. I know that. I know that. It's very good. Very good percentage. Besada. But there's that, you know, big American Jewish community out there and Canadian Jewish community. And by the way, Canadian Jewish community percentage-wise does better than America. And it has to do with, ready for this one? A solid functioning Bnei Akiva organization. Where there's solid functioning Bnei Akiva, the numbers are higher. And that's why in England they're higher, in France they're higher, in Melbourne, Australia they're higher, and in Toronto they're higher. In America, you know, you have other organizations doing wonderful work. I'm not believing the NCSY doing wonderful work, but they're not promoting Aliyah. Dorosh Baruch Hu was being very, very kind to us. Very kind. Because for that moment, we gelled as one people. And when Am Yisrael gel as one people, we get another shot. We got another shot. But Esther sacrificed herself on a personal level. For sure, she was a korban. She sacrificed herself for Am Yisrael. And we should remember that 11th chapter. That's important about Esther's personal life and what ultimately happens with Am Yisrael. The continuity is the unwritten 11th chapter of the Megillah. And also, we don't talk about how many Jews lost their lives in the brawls. We knocked off 5,000 and 75,000 throughout the 127. Okay, what is it, a shutout? This was an NBA basketball game, 100-0? What happened to us? We didn't want to talk about it. In Yiddish we say it's a shter in the simcha. It would ruin the simcha. So we don't talk about it. But there were Jews who were killed and maimed and wounded, for sure. How can you not have that? If the other side sustained losses of 80,000 people. So, all right, you should remember that too. It's like we remember Yom HaZikaron, the day before Yom HaTzmaut. We remember it. And it's important to remember it. I said this, yeah. Right. It's very sad. She sacrificed herself, right? Okay, let's have a nice Purim. Purim Sameach. We should be involved in Yeshno Am Echad. Yeshno Am Echad. We should pull ourselves together, all the Narish guide out on the street, and Mitzvah Hashem. So, you know, Mitzvah Hashem, I'll be here in 3 weeks, and you'll have a nice year by Rabbi Sam on the... Yeah, I mentioned I'm not going to be here for the next 2 Sundays. Rabbi Sam Shaw is going to give a shiur for 2 weeks on the Agoda. If you want to hear me speak in Las Vegas a week from tomorrow, you're invited. I'm speaking about Rambam and Minhagim, at a Jewish Studies conference, yeah.